Welcome to another episode of My Weird Prompts, an AI-generated podcast featuring the random prompts of Daniel Rosehill as answered by a revolving cast of friendly AI characters. Join us for deep dives into AI, technology, and whatever other random thing Daniel finds fascinating today. Subscribe on Spotify or your favorite podcatcher. Now, today's episode.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Hi there, Herman and Corin. So we talked earlier today about the perils of gallbladder removal, and you gave me some very useful dietary advice. I mentioned that I was really struggling, have been struggling for a number of years with the effects of gallbladder removal. And I think probably, I suspect, like more people than we hear about, I went into the surgery being told that you can just eat whatever you want. And then, you know, the gallbladder does... It's a very primitive organ. And I remember after the surgery, you know, when you don't have that body part anymore in your body, reading about these discoveries about the gallbladder and it being doing all these things that we didn't know about. And that's always what terrifies me about these operations that are almost, I wouldn't call this elective, but you feel like they're undertaken sometimes a little bit too hastily. And I would put the removal of my dear gallbladder in that category. In general, I have huge respect for medicine and great things to say about the medicine we have here in Israel. But in this particular case, it felt like I went to the doctor for an ache. They said, it might be the gallbladder, let's just take it out anyway. And then the next day, the hospital was calling me to schedule the surgery. And it all felt very, very quick. So I can say that my consent was not informed. I signed a form, but it was all done in a very rapid way. And when I read these things about, you know, when we discover in retrospect that the gallbladder actually wasn't just this dumb little sack holding bile, and I know it's a weird topic to talk about for those who have their gallbladders, but I've been of the opinion or have formed the opinion that we are maybe doing this way too readily and without a full understanding of the biology at play. Now, I know that in some cases, it's a really kind of life or death thing. And, you know, people can develop gangrene and crazy complications. And I'm not talking about those cases. I'm talking about the more mundane cases where it's actually very unusual in the grand scheme of our body parts that the mainstream treatment for an issue is now the removal of the organ, which it is for the gallbladder. We don't even attempt to treat it with the old medications anymore, by and large. So I don't have a gallbladder. I can't get it back, to the best of my knowledge. I would like to, because it would be nice not to be bloated after I eat. But maybe Herman's tips will be helpful in that respect. But what I would love to know about is that this is a surgery that is very, very, it's being performed since the advent of laparoscopy, which moves the recovery times a lot shorter. I don't know what the numbers are, but they're huge. Lots and lots of people are having their gallbladders removed. And when I went on to Facebook after the op, and maybe a few months after, and I was really thinking, hey, this isn't what I was told. This is kind of becoming a long-term problem. And it was worse than I was before the op, for no doubt. And I came across these Facebook groups, some of which were really scary, actually, because they were just so negative. Gallbladder surgery removed my life, ruined my life. And you'd see these groups with like tens of thousands of people. Now, of course, you're not going to see the people who had a successful outcome for the operation. But it struck me that there is a really substantial group of people who probably would agree with me that cholecystectomy is in many cases just being rushed into, and we're doing so without a full understanding of the importance of this organ, and maybe overestimating the degree to which humans can live without a gallbladder. What blows my mind is that up to a relatively recent point in time in history, that just wasn't possible. We never did it. So that's where I'd love to kind of start the conversation with both of you. I'd love to know really if we're putting any thought, if medicine's putting any thought into this issue of maybe more conservative management of gallbladder, maybe putting more emphasis on preserving the organ where possible. And for the rather large amount of people, I think, who do deal with things like post-cholecystectomy syndrome, long-term complications from the organ removal, is there any hope on the way for us? There's obviously things we can do with our diet, but as Herman described it recently, there's also the fact that the plumbing has fundamentally changed in our bodies. And I think there needs to be some, I hope someone's working on some kind of a long-term, you know, something for people who do have these challenging outcomes that can help us, because a lot of us could use it. So Herman and Corin, let's talk today about the prevalence of post-cholecystectomy syndrome. Let's talk about how long we've been removing gallbladders. When was the first gallbladder that was removed, for that matter? And to my point, do you think the medical establishment is learning more about the gallbladder and moving in this direction? And to finally come to my sort of motive here, is there any hope on the way for better treatments for long-term management of gallbladderless life? Herman and Corin, let's talk about gallbladders.
Hey everyone, welcome back to My Weird Prompts. I am Corin, and I'm sitting here in our living room in Jerusalem with my brother.
Herman Poppleberry, at your service. It is good to be back at the microphones. We had a bit of a milestone recently with episode 200, and it feels like we are just getting started.
It really does. And today we have a topic that is actually quite personal for our housemate Daniel. He sent us over a prompt about something he has been dealing with for a while now, and honestly, it is something I think a lot of people go through without really talking about the long-term reality of it.
Right. Daniel was asking about the gallbladder, specifically the history of gallbladder removal, what happens when it goes wrong, and whether the medical world is starting to rethink how often we just take this organ out.
He mentioned post-cholecystectomy syndrome, which sounds like quite a mouthful. But before we get into the complications, I think we should probably set the stage. I mean, the gallbladder is one of those organs people don't really think about until it starts causing immense pain.
Exactly. It is this little pear-shaped sac tucked under the liver. Its primary job is to store and concentrate bile, which the liver produces. When you eat something fatty, the gallbladder squeezes that bile into the small intestine to help break down the fats. Most people think of it as a disposable part, like an appendix, but as Daniel has found out, once it is gone, the plumbing of your digestive system is permanently altered.
So, let's start with the history. Because Daniel was curious about when this all began. When was the first time someone actually decided to just remove the whole thing?
It is actually a fascinating bit of medical history. The very first successful gallbladder removal, or cholecystectomy, was performed on July 15, 1882.
1882? That is earlier than I expected.
It was performed by a German surgeon named Karl Langenbuch in Berlin. And what is interesting is his reasoning. At the time, other surgeons were experimenting with just opening the gallbladder, taking out the stones, and sewing it back up. But Langenbuch had this famous saying, "The gallbladder needs to be removed not because it contains stones, but because it forms them."
That is a very bold stance for the 1880s. He was basically saying the organ itself was the factory that was broken, so you had to shut down the factory entirely.
Precisely. His first patient was a 42-year-old man who had been suffering from gallstone pain for years. Langenbuch made a T-shaped incision, removed the organ, and the patient actually recovered. But for the next 100 years, it was a major open surgery. You had a large scar, a long hospital stay, and a significant recovery period.
And then things changed in the late 20th century, right? That is when the laparoscopic revolution happened.
Yeah, and that is really where the prevalence of the surgery exploded. In the mid to late 1980s, surgeons like Eric Muchia in Germany and Philippe Moret in France pioneered the laparoscopic approach. Instead of a huge incision, you just had a few small holes. This turned a major operation into something that, in many cases, is now an outpatient procedure. You can have your gallbladder removed in the morning and be home by the evening.
Which leads us to Daniel's point about whether we are doing it too much. Because it became so easy and relatively safe, did it become the default answer for even minor issues?
That is the big question. Currently, in the United States alone, roughly 700,000 to 800,000 cholecystectomies are performed every single year. It is one of the most common elective abdominal surgeries in the world. And because the success rate for stopping the acute pain of gallstones is so high, there hasn't been a lot of pushback until very recently.
But that brings us to the post-cholecystectomy syndrome Daniel mentioned. If the surgery is so successful, why are so many people, like Daniel, still struggling years later?
This is where the medical establishment is starting to look closer. Post-cholecystectomy syndrome, or PCS, is a bit of a catch-all term. It refers to symptoms like indigestion, diarrhea, bloating, and even right-sided pain that persists or develops after the surgery. Recent reviews suggest that a substantial minority of patients, in some studies approaching 4 in 10, experience some form of PCS, depending on how strictly it is defined.
That is a huge number for a surgery that is often described as having no long-term downsides.
It really is. And the reasons for it are multifaceted. Sometimes it is a structural issue, like a stone left behind in the bile duct, or a problem with the sphincter of Oddi, which is the little valve that controls the flow of bile into the intestine. But in many cases, it is simply because you have changed the flow of bile. Without a gallbladder, bile isn't stored and released in a big burst when you eat. Instead, it drips continuously from the liver into the small intestine.
So it is like a leaky faucet instead of a pressurized hose.
That is a perfect analogy. And that constant drip of bile can irritate the lining of the stomach or the intestines. It can lead to what is called bile acid malabsorption, where the bile salts aren't reabsorbed properly at the end of the small intestine, which causes that urgent watery diarrhea after eating.
It sounds like a classic case of solving one problem, the gallstone pain, but creating a chronic, systemic issue in its place. Which leads to Daniel's second question. Is the medical establishment moving toward more conservative management or organ preservation?
There has been a noticeable shift in just the last few years. A landmark study called the Seagull Trial reported that for many people with uncomplicated symptomatic gallstones, starting with conservative management observation and pain control can lead to quality of life outcomes comparable to immediate surgery, and it is more cost-effective, although some patients ultimately still need an operation. In fact, it's significantly more cost-effective and avoids the risk of PCS entirely for those who never go on to have surgery.
That is a big deal. So we are moving away from the 1882 mindset that the factory is broken and must be shut down.
Slowly, yes. In the West, the standard is still often removal, but watchful waiting is now a clinically supported first step. And then there is the research coming out of China regarding gallbladder-preserving surgery.
Is that the one where they just take the stones out?
Exactly. It is called cholecystectomy gallbladder preserving cholecystolithotomy. While Western surgeons have long been skeptical, claiming the stones will just come back, large Chinese series of gallbladder preserving surgery have reported relatively low stone recurrence rates over long-term follow-up, often on the order of about 10-20%, which is lower than many assumed and preserves the organ's function.
That seems like a game changer. Why isn't that being done everywhere?
There is still a lot of institutional momentum behind removal. But as Daniel's experience shows, the definition of a successful surgery needs to include the long-term quality of life, not just the absence of stones. If you remove the organ and the patient ends up with chronic digestive issues for 20 years, was that really a better outcome?
Right. So, for those who have already had the surgery and are dealing with these long-term complications, is there hope? What does the landscape look like in 2026 for managing life without a gallbladder?
There is a lot of hope, specifically coming from a better understanding of the gut microbiome and bile acid metabolism. Many patients were historically advised to follow a low-fat diet after surgery, but more recent thinking recognizes that very low-fat intake can sometimes make things worse. If you eat zero fat, the bile still drips into your intestine but has nothing to do, so it just sits there and irritates the lining.
So you actually need a little bit of fat to give the bile a job?
Precisely. Small, frequent amounts of healthy fats like olive oil help emulsify that steady drip. And we have better diagnostic tools now, like the CHCAT scan, which can definitively prove if someone has bile acid malabsorption. Once you have that diagnosis, you can use targeted bile acid sequestrants like colesevelam, which bind to the excess bile so it doesn't irritate the colon.
And what about the microbiome research you mentioned earlier?
That is the most exciting part. Research from 2025 identified specific bile salt hydrolase active bacteria. These are the microbes that help your body process and recycle bile. We are starting to see the development of precision probiotics designed specifically for post-cholecystectomy patients to help their microbiome handle that constant bile flow.
So instead of just trying to soak up the bile, we are trying to help the bacteria process it more effectively. It is about finding a new equilibrium.
Exactly. It is the classic medical arc. We find a surgical solution, it becomes the gold standard, and then we spend the next few decades realizing the nuance of what we lost. For Daniel and others, the future isn't just eat less fat. It is a personalized protocol, the right fiber to bind the bile, the right probiotic to protect the colon, and a meal schedule that matches the liver's output.
You know, it reminds me of our discussion back in episode 105 about AI benchmarks. We often look for one single metric or one single solution, like removing the gallbladder, and we think, okay, problem solved. But biology is full of interconnected dependencies. You pull one thread, and the whole tapestry shifts.
That is such a good point, Korn. A tiny drip in the wrong place over a long period of time can cause massive structural damage. A constant drip of bile into an empty intestine is a biological leak that eventually erodes the quality of life.
Well, Herman, I think we have covered the history, the current shift in thinking, and the hope for the future. I hope this gives Daniel some context for why things have been so difficult. It isn't just in his head, it is a fundamental shift in his body's chemistry.
It really is. And to our listeners, if you are facing the surgery, ask about the Seagull trial and conservative management. If you have already had it, look into bile binders and microbiome support. You don't have to accept these symptoms as your new normal.
Well said. Before we wrap up, I want to thank Daniel for sending in such a thoughtful and personal prompt. If you have your own story to share, you can find our contact form at myweirdprompts.com.
And if you enjoyed this deep dive, please leave us a review on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. It genuinely helps other curious minds find the show.
It really does. All right, this has been My Weird Prompts. I am Korn.
And I am Herman Poppleberry.
We will see you next time.
Until then, keep asking the weird questions.
Let's go get some lunch, Herman. Small, frequent portions?
Exactly. Maybe some oats for that soluble fiber.
Perfect. See ya.
See ya.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. Text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox Turbo.
Thanks for listening to another episode of My Weird Prompts, an AI-generated podcast featuring Daniel Rosehill's AI prompts, as answered by a revolving cast of friendly AI characters including me, Cornelius the Sloth. Subscribe on Spotify or visit myweirdprompts.com.